From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. It's Wednesday, July 6th. I'm Marco Werman. Outrage in Britain over a newspaper's phone hacking. Targets reportedly included murder and terrorism victims. Also, the Obama administration defends its decision to fly a Somali terrorism suspect to New York to face a civilian trial. Plus, in California, how things can go wrong when a candidate's name appears in Chinese on a ballot.
And to my surprise, because I don't read Chinese, they had translated my name literally into wheat can be kindness, which doesn't mean anything.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, celebrating the selection of Dr. Dini Zolnaun from the University of North Carolina as the 2011 Society for Women's Health Research Medtronic Prize recipient. More about her contribution to women's health and her work in gynecological pain at swhr.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Britain's tabloid press is known to go to great lengths to get the lowdown on celebrities and politicians. Tabloid readers across the pond are used to that. But now there's outrage in Britain over how one newspaper reportedly hacked into a murdered girl's mobile phone messages while she was missing. The News of the World has also been accused of hacking into the phones of some of the relatives of the July 7th, 2005 terrorist bombings in London. British Prime Minister David Cameron today backed calls for an independent inquiry into the scandal.
Let us be clear, we are no longer talking here about politicians and celebrities. We're talking about murder victims, potentially terrorist victims, having their phones hacked into. It is absolutely disgusting at what has taken place, and I think everyone in this House, and indeed this country, will be revolted by what they've heard and what they've seen on their television screens.
Graham Foulkes' son David was killed in the 2005 terror attacks. He says he's been told by police that his phone may have been hacked soon after the bombings.
There was a week when we had no communication from the authorities about whether David was alive in intensive care or had been declared dead. And we were chatting to friends on the phone in a very personal and deeply emotional context. And the thought that somebody may have been listening to that, just looking for a cheap headline, is just horrendous.
The phone hacking scandal has sparked a political and media storm in Britain. The BBC's Rob Watson has been following the story. He's in London. Rob, the paper News of the World, which is in the crosshairs here, it's part of Rupert Murdoch's media empire. What kind of publication is it?
It's pretty racy stuff, the News of the World. Lots of tidbits about celebrities, people who've been doing naughty things, footballers who've been sleeping with people that aren't their wives. I think that probably gives you a pretty much of a flavor of what the News of the World is like.
I mean, this isn't a new thing in the UK. One should recall the days when the cell phone of Prince Charles was hacked. So why is the British government now suddenly giving this very serious privacy issue their full attention?
You've really hit on it. This isn't new. It's certainly not new that Britain's tabloids are raunchy, racy, and that they use pushy methods in their reporting techniques. You're absolutely right. In fact, the hacking isn't even new. It was known that certain celebrities, Hollywood stars, have had their phones hacked. But what has happened, why we've suddenly got this crescendo, almost a crisis, is because there's a feeling that a red line has been crossed, that it's one thing to hack into the phone messages of some celebrity to find out who they're in love with or not in love with, but just quite another thing to hack into the phone messages either of murder victims or relatives of those victims. It's as if that line has been crossed.
What could happen to the News of the World if the allegations are proved to be true?
Let's take first things first. There is a continuing police investigation, and there's certainly the possibility that people will be prosecuted, that they will go to court, and that perhaps people will go to prison. Now, there's something else going on, and that is that there's going to be clearly a much wider public inquiry into media ethics in this country. Now, will that lead to the defanging of Britain's infamous tabloid press? Well, I'm not so sure about that. People have declared the demise of the tabloids or their taming in the past, and so far they always emerge. But there's no doubt this is a very uncomfortable period for the tabloid press and for the News of the World in particular. And then, of course, there's a political dimension to this story, because it just so happens that David Cameron was rather friendly with some of the executives at News International, and indeed, he even had a former editor of the News of the World until recently as his director of communications. So the political opposition in this country is saying, aha, look at him, see what kind of judgment he's got, look who he employed as his director of communications.
Right. So short-term implications for News of the World, readership up or down?
Well, they've got some immediate problems on their hand, which is some rather big-name advertisers saying, we're not sure that we want to carry on advertising in your newspaper while all of these allegations are out there. And there have been some campaigns calling for a boycott. But I suspect that the outcome is going to be something like this, that there likely will be resignations, possibly even prosecutions involving News of the World and the broader News International, News Corporation group. I suspect that reputations are going to be severely damaged. I think it's going to be very uncomfortable for David Cameron for a while. But as to the long-term future of the tabloid press, don't write it off.
The BBC's Rob Watson in London. Thank you so much, Rob.
Thank you.
The war in the Democratic Republic of Congo has officially been over for several years now, but there are still more than a dozen armed groups fighting each other throughout the eastern part of the country. Many of them use child soldiers, sometimes as children are forced to join, other times they join voluntarily. Dennis Porter has a story of one girl soldier from the village of Lukanga in eastern Congo.
Clementine Katungu Kalenja isn't what you'd expect of a former child soldier. She's soft-spoken, shy, and she's constantly laughing. Even when she describes her first battle against government soldiers, here at this spot, she was 15 years old.
I was standing on the porch and I saw where they were coming from. They began to shoot over there. We heard shooting down at the roadblock and we were asking who's shooting.
She says she and other girls were armed only with rocks, but she claims that a sorcerer put a magic potion on the rocks so they exploded like grenades. Kalenja became a soldier 8 years ago. She was kicked out of school because she couldn't pay her school fees. With nothing else to do, she and four other girls set off into the mountains to find the Mai Mai camp.
I did not tell my family, I just went to join the Mai Mai. I felt like being a fighter made me important.
Her father, Jean Murahinga, says when he came home that afternoon, she was gone.
I asked around and one of the neighbors told me that she went and joined Mai Mai. I was angry and afraid to hear that my daughter had joined that group.
The Mai Mai were set up by the Congolese government to protect against foreign militias. Dozens of Mai Mai groups dot eastern Congo. They rob and sometimes kill people, but other armed groups around here, including the government soldiers, are often more brutal. So the Mai Mai sometimes have the reluctant support of villagers. Masika Kasioko is an elder in Kalenja's village. She says she's seen many children join the Mai Mai, often for food.
Some of the children were hungry, and when they heard that in Mai Mais they have meat, they have bread, they said, oh, that is where we have to go.
Kalenja says it didn't take long to realize she'd made a mistake joining the Mai Mai. In her first battle, her friend was shot dead in front of her. She says she tried to leave, but Mai Mai leaders said her father would have to give them 10 goats in compensation, about five times her family's annual income. So Kalenja was stuck, fighting foreign militias and sometimes government troops.
We were fighting the National Congolese Army and Ugandan rebels and Rwandans. We were just fighting because it was war. It's the leaders who understood, but the rest of us, we did not know why.
Kalenja finally got to go home after the army raided the Mai Mai camp. but some Mai Mai fighters showed up at her hut and demanded her father compensate them for her release.
They came here with knives and said, if you don't have a goat, they are going to be a problem. You better get a goat. If I gave them one goat, then she could go back to school.
Kalenji's father gave them a goat, and then he sent her away for her own protection. She spent half a year in a rehabilitation program for former child soldiers.
They told us if we went to school, they would help pay for our school fees, or else they'll train us to be tailor or carpenter.
In the past few years, things have been improving for the villagers. Fewer children are joining the ranks of the Mai Mai. But for many of the former child soldiers, life is difficult. Masika Kasioko says many villagers don't trust them.
Men fear them. Men fear them very, very hard. They said, even if I marry this girl, perhaps in the future she can kill me.
Kalenja is now 23 and still trying to finish high school. But she's run into the same problem that drove her to join the Mai Mai in the first place. Her school funding ran out, so she was kicked out of school again.
The teachers are not paid by the government, so if we don't pay the fees, they don't get the salary. That's why I can't go to school.
But Kalenja says even if she can't finish school, she is not going back to the Mai Mai. For The World, I'm Dennis Porter, the village of Lukanga in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Pernilla Ironside is the UNICEF Child Protection Specialist in Emergencies. Pernilla, you've worked with kids who've become soldiers in many parts of the world, including Congo. So here's the story of a very young woman who voluntarily joined a local militia to pay her school fees. Is this a typical case?
Unfortunately, it is a reality for many children in war-affected countries where they're struggling for survival. So many of these children do not have enough to eat at home. They don't have opportunities to go to school. And they may have whether ideological reasons to join or have experienced themselves attacks on their families or on their communities that drive them through vengeance to join groups such as the Mai Mai in an effort to gain some power and control over their lives.
Is forcible recruitment and kidnapping just as common?
Unfortunately, it is in many contexts. Many thousands of children are forcibly recruited each year, abducted, kidnapped from their homes, and forced to join up with brutal armed groups that engage in all sorts of activities.
Can these kids ever really kind of return to normal after they've been through, you know, these militias?
Absolutely. I myself have interviewed many children who, you know, when they've come out of these terrible situations, have exhibit real symptoms of distress. And with time and the support services that they receive, they can make a full kind of reintegration into their communities and their homes. We have a number of success stories where, in fact, they've gone on to develop successful businesses and, in fact, contribute back to their communities and even themselves become mentors to other children who are following in their footsteps and having come out recently from armed groups. We have a case in point in Bukavu in eastern DRC where one boy has developed a successful mechanics business and is now mentoring and taking on as apprentices a number of other former child soldiers.
Do you think the support services know how to work with these former child soldiers better today than, say, during the war in Sierra Leone?
The challenge is that we're operating these programs in countries that have very weak systems for providing social services or social welfare. In all of Eastern Congo, there is one psychiatrist. Psychologists are very far and few between. So what we try to do as UNICEF is to build capacities of the government for services such as counseling and social welfare system, and strengthen those of local NGOs as well who can provide this.
Pernilla Ironside is a UNICEF Child Protection Specialist in Emergencies. She's worked to help rehabilitate child soldiers in many war-ravaged countries. Pernilla, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Still ahead, Operation Nanook heads north on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic. leveraging products, people, partnerships, and philanthropy to help change the way the world addresses the global epidemic of chronic diseases such as diabetes and heart disease. More about Medtronic's chronic disease commitment at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The South Korean city of Pyeongchang got the nod today. It was chosen to host the 2018 Winter Olympics after a decade of trying. Pyeongchang edged out Munich and Annecy in France in the first round of a secret ballot of the International Olympic Committee. Jason Strother reports on the reaction in Seoul.
There were a lot of tense people sitting in Seoul Plaza today, eyes fixed on a big TV screen, waiting for the decision.
At the 23rd Olympic Winter Games in 2018, awarded to the city of... Pyeongchang.
After two consecutive unsuccessful bids, Pyeongchang finally got its chance to host the Winter Games. An Kyung-an says she's thrilled Korea won this time.
We are also very stunned because we tried every time.
Pyeongchang is the center for winter sports in Korea, but many here say the Olympics could turn it into an international destination. That sounds a little ambitious, says Jason Lee, a sportscaster with Korea's Arirang TV. But he says Pyeongchang resorts are already luring some foreign skiers.
They're bringing people from countries that don't have snow, from Southeast Asia, from Africa, and they've got good intentions in trying to make Pyeongchang an area where it's not just central to Korea.
With today's decision, South Korea becomes the second Asian nation after Japan to get the Winter Games. For The World, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
California is home to the largest Asian-American population in the nation, and nearly a third of Asian-American voters in California aren't proficient in English. That can be a problem come election season. By law, election materials must be translated in districts with sizable linguistic minorities. But the law, in California at least, doesn't specify how they are translated. Some lawmakers are trying to change that. Nina Porzuki reports.
5 years ago, candidate Mike Eng opened up his sample election ballot and
when I saw how my name was spelled after someone told me about it, I literally almost fell out of my seat.
Eng was running, successfully it turned out, for a seat in the California Assembly. About 40% of his district is Asian American. And not just the ballots, but the official sample ballots that get mailed ahead of time have to be translated under federal law into four Asian languages: Chinese, Japanese, Vietnamese, and Korean. So when Eng was asked if he wanted his name translated onto the ballot, he thought, well, of course.
And to my surprise, because I don't read Chinese, it turned out that they had translated my name literally, Michael Eng, into what in Chinese sounded like Maiko N. And if you read that literally, it actually translates to wheat can be kindness, which of course doesn't mean anything.
When Chinese characters are strung together to create phonetic transliterations of Western names, they can sometimes turn into pretty nonsensical sayings, like, well, wheat can be kindness. But it turns out Eng, who is Chinese-American, also has a Chinese name, one that was given to him at birth by his grandparents.
My name in Mandarin is Wu Guaqing, and my name in Cantonese is Ng Gokhen.
His Chinese name has nothing to do with wheat, or kindness for that matter, but means pride of our national day. This was the name used by the Chinese media, the name that many voters knew him by. So Ang ended up spending the rest of his campaign telling voters
that this person whose name sounded like wheat in Chinese was actually me.
Despite the confusion, Ang won the election. But the situation still bothers him. Unlike English, written Chinese is based on meaning and not sound. And you might think Ang is hung up on the fact that his name meant wheat. But meaning is a big deal in Chinese writing, says lexicographer David Praker Branner. Take his name, David. In English, no one really thinks about what it means. But when he uses his Chinese name, Lo Wei, the meaning is right there.
If I write my name Lo Wei, I am writing the word that means sort of virtuous inner strength and the word that means the power to awe. These words, these characters, they're used. They're part of normal language. So meaning is right in your face with the Chinese writing system. You can't escape it.
Under the Voting Rights Act, certain jurisdictions are required to provide minority language assistance. This means translated materials, ballots, signs, bilingual poll workers. But the federal law is silent about name translation. Some states regulate how names appear on the ballot in character-based languages like Chinese, but not California. In California, the rules change from one jurisdiction to the next. Assemblymember Mike Ang's situation was unfortunate, but by no means the most extreme example of a name change. Some candidates may even have used this gray area of the law to gain favor with Asian American voters. In 2010, someone named Lei Jingping ran for San Francisco Superior Court judge using this TV ad.
Lei Jingping, Josie Lim Jing.
But that wasn't his birth name.
No hi, Michael Nava, Lei Jingping.
Yep, Lei Jingping was candidate Michael Nava. Lei Jingping is a very Chinese-sounding name, and a good one for a judicial candidate. It means correct and fair. An attractive Chinese name for Michael Nava to have chosen.
Right now, it's the Wild Wild West.
Again, Assemblymember Mike Ng.
And if you want to say that my name means giver of millions of dollars in profits to local governments, then one could list your name on the ballot that way.
Ng isn't alone in worrying about this issue. California State Senator Leland Yee has introduced a bill about how candidates' names are translated into character-based languages.
I think all of us, want good-sounding names that would engender warmth with the Chinese vote. But I think that when you do that solely for the purpose of gathering that vote and nothing else, then I think it's a little unfair.
A version of the bill was vetoed in 2009 by then-Governor Schwarzenegger, who declared that individual jurisdictions should decide this matter on their own. But Yee reintroduced it this year. It's critical, he says, to create one uniform policy to protect the integrity of the vote.
If Chinese Americans all of a sudden think that the voting process is a sham and that politicians are just simply trying to trick them, they're less inclined to participate in the electoral process.
Dean Logan is the registrar of voters in Los Angeles County. Under the proposed law, he would have to decide on which translations to use. He's uncomfortable with that.
It's an appropriate role for someone, and I think it needs to happen. I'm just not sure that that having that be the role of the registrar gets you to where you want to be with this, because I think you could ultimately still have somebody then turn around and challenge that in court, which further delays the process.
It's somewhat surprising that California, with its large Asian American population, lags behind other states like New York, where policy about candidates' names has been in place for well over a decade. But that may change in the next few months. Assemblymember Ang certainly hopes so.
Your name is your identity. Your name is your heritage. Your name is your family. Your name really is something that you can be proud of. And I look forward to the day where we can actually have a ballot that does really reflect the true identity of those that are running, because that's better democracy.
That may be the case when he runs for re-election, if the bill makes it to Governor Brown's desk and he signs it into law. Then Assemblymember Ng will have to bid farewell to his doppelganger friend, Wheat Can Be Kindness. For the world, I'm Nina Porzuki.
The day's top news stories are next on PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Still ahead, helping immigrants navigate the U.S. job market by practicing networking and interviewing.
It's really good practice. At least right now, I can open my mouth, you know, to talk. You know, before today, you know, I was shy. I learned a lot.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, celebrating the selection of Dr. Dini Zolnaun from the University of North Carolina as the 2011 Society for Women's Health Research Medtronic Prize recipient. More about her contribution to women's health and her work in gynecological pain at swhr.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. The Obama administration today defended its handling of terrorism suspect Ahmed Abdulkader Warsame. The administration flew the Somali detainee to New York to face a civilian trial. Warsame is allegedly a fighter for the Somali militant group al-Shabaab and has ties to al-Qaeda. The suspect was arrested by the U.S. military in April, somewhere in the Persian Gulf region. He was then held aboard a U.S. Navy ship for over 2 months before being brought to New York. Matthew Waxman is a former Pentagon advisor on detention issues. First, Mr. Waxman, tell us who Ahmed Abdulkader Warsame is and what he's charged with specifically.
Well, some of the facts are still coming out. We only have a limited picture of what the U.S. government knows of him. It appears that he's affiliated with an operational member of al-Shabaab, the militant group in Somalia, and also, according to the government, has strong ties to al-Qaeda's branch in Yemen, al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula.
Now, Warsame was interrogated by the military on a ship for 2 months. That seems highly unusual. And, I mean, is it even legal? It sounds more like a floating prison than an interrogation.
Well, it is unusual that he was held on a naval vessel for that period of detention. On the other hand, for a decade now, the United States has been arguing consistently across presidential administrations that as a matter of both domestic law and international law, it is engaged in an ongoing war or armed conflict with al-Qaeda, and as a result, it can legally capture and hold for the duration of hostilities enemy fighters in that war, meaning those fighting on behalf of enemy forces, al-Qaeda and its affiliates and allies.
Now, having Warsame tried in civilian court is highly controversial here in the U.S. Tell us why it is, and what is the Obama administration's argument for trying him in civilian court, and what's the congressional Republicans' argument against it?
Yeah, this case certainly comes at a tense time in negotiations between the White House and congressional Republicans about detention law generally. You have congressional Republicans wanting to prohibit the use of civilian criminal justice for terrorism suspects captured abroad like this, and arguing that they should only be held abroad, perhaps at Guantanamo, and maybe prosecuted for war crimes in military commissions. The Obama administration argues that Guantanamo should be closed and that the government should have some flexibility to choose among a variety of legal tools for handling terrorism suspects on a case-by-case basis. And the congressional Republicans are trying to restrict the kinds of options that the government could use in cases like this.
Well, you're a law professor now. You think about these things a lot. Who's right here?
Well, I think the Obama administration is right on that point. In my view, the congressional Republican effort to restrict the president's options and basically take civilian criminal prosecution off the table is misguided both as a matter of principle and also even from a counterterrorism perspective. I think, as this case shows, each case has its own complexities, difficulties, and I don't think there is any one-size-fits-all approach that's going to be appropriate across all terrorism cases, and I think it's dangerous to restrict the president's flexibility in cases like this.
Apparently, Warsame was not treated as a civilian detainee from the get-go and was perhaps not even read his Miranda rights. Would that pose a legal challenge in civilian court?
That's one of the issues that's likely to come up. From what we know, his period of initial detention and interrogation lasting a couple of months was not done with his Miranda rights having been read. In other words, without having been given an opportunity to consult with a lawyer, to remain silent, and so forth. one open question is, to what degree do constitutional rights like Miranda apply abroad to terrorism suspects like this who are held in military custody? And that's, I think, one of the legal issues that's likely to arise in the subsequent prosecution that's being brought. The stakes are high. If courts end up holding that Miranda and other constitutional rights do apply quite broadly to these kinds of foreign suspects picked up abroad, that could really impact future terrorism prosecutions and the kinds of choices that this president and subsequent presidents will make in cases like this.
Matthew Waxman, Associate Professor of Law at Columbia University in New York. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much for having me.
Is he or isn't he? Dead, that is. The he in question is former Chinese President Jiang Zemin. There have been hints in public, online, offline, and on TV over the past few days that Zhang has died, but no official confirmation. The World's Mary Kay Magsat is in Beijing. Mary Kay, what is the latest on this mystery?
Well, the latest is on the 10 o'clock news on China's central television. The lead story was not Zhang's death. There's a lot of speculation about who was going to win the 2018 Winter Olympics. And Chinese censors are blocking conversation or speculation about Zhang on the official internet here. You can get around that through using a proxy server, but many Chinese can't do that.
What set off the rumor mill in the first place?
Well, for starters, Zhang did not appear at the 90th anniversary of the founding of the Communist Party of China, which was on July 1st, and many other former leaders were there, so he would have been expected to have been there. But also, there have been rumors for a while that his health isn't great. This particular set of rumors started very late Tuesday night in Beijing. The media that first went with the story that Jiang Zemin had died were a couple of media sites that are linked to the spiritual sect Falun Gong, which is banned in China. And those sites are not always the most accurate when it comes to what's going on in China. However, there appeared to be a little more credibility to the reports when they came out in Hong Kong, both from Asia TV and TVB. And Asia TV is known to have relatively close links to the party. However, they went with a report earlier in the evening that Zhang had died and said that they were going to run a special report at 9:30 p.m. But when 9:30 came around, they instead ran a South Korean soap opera.
Mary Kay, I understand that one hint that something was up was that certain words were no longer searchable online. Explain that.
Well, what actually happened, it's hard to know which came first, but I think the rumors came first, and then censors stepped in and said, okay, you're not going to search for the word Zhang, which is, of course, Zhang Zemin's surname, but it also means river. So that makes it difficult to search for the Chinese name for the Yangtze River, which is Changjiang. It also comes up, obviously, in many other contexts, so it's a little bit inconvenient. There were also blockages for words like heart attack, party secretary, and, of course, for Jiang Zemin's name. If something like this were to happen, and we don't know that it has, the party likes to control the story. I was here in China in the 90s when Deng Xiaoping died, and the story was released at 2 a.m. There had been rumors, there had been concerns, and it wasn't floating around the way that this rumor has been because there wasn't the kind of internet reach that there is now in China. But the party decided to release the information and go, you know, full bore with memorial tributes on television, radio, and newspapers starting at 2 a.m. And if Jiang Zemin has died, they will release the information when they're ready to.
You know, I know how the Chinese government can be very protective of information, but why control the story of the death of a former president, especially if it is true?
Because, again, Jiang Zemin is the party's guy. They want to be able to be out in front of the story. They would actually probably consider someone getting in front of them on the story to be a leaking of state secrets, which makes it even more puzzling that two Hong Kong media went ahead and reported it.
In other words, if that information were controlled by, say, Chinese government opposition, they feel like they might be able to manipulate that and they would lose the game?
Well, there really isn't a Chinese government opposition in any sort of organized form. And many of the people who had been most outspoken as social critics or as lawyers have been detained and threatened and silenced in the last few months. So it's not so much that as that the party is just very control happy. When there's a story like this, these are their iconic leaders, even if Jiang Zemin isn't quite on the level of Deng Xiaoping or Mao Zedong, his three represents thought is one of the pieces of philosophy that Communist Party members study. And the Communist Party wants to control the narrative whenever a leader like this passes on.
Mary Kay Magstad, the world's Beijing correspondent. Mary Kay, thank you so much.
Thank you, Marco.
Mary Kay has written a blog post about Jiang Zemin. You can read that and explore our other reporter blogs. That's at theworld.org/blogs. Searching for a job can be a daunting task, especially during bad economic times. It's even more daunting if you're new to a country and don't know how job hunting is done there. Many highly skilled immigrants face that challenge here in the U.S. They may be qualified for good jobs, but not experienced in things like networking or the all-important elevator pitch. Monica Campbell reports from Oakland, California, where a nonprofit group helps immigrants learn the finer points of American-style job hunting.
On a recent Saturday morning in downtown Oakland, Kasim Kasim waits to enter a large meeting room. The clean-cut 28-year-old from Iraq is pretty nervous. Finally, after years of work and study in both Iraq and China, and while waiting for his American visa, he's here in California, interviewing for his dream job as a marketing executive at Google.
It's a very competitive company. We have a lot of qualified candidates. What would make you differentiate from myself? Why should we hire you?
Well, I'm from Iraq, and I lived in China, and I made it all the way here. And then my aim or my goal is just to make the connection between these three worlds. And I think once we get them all together with a person with my qualification, it will make Google best or better.
Kasim stumbles a bit, but it's okay. The interview isn't real. It's a dry run, practice, for when Kasim gets, he hopes, a real crack at Google. It's all part of a workshop run by the nonprofit Upwardly Global. The group helps immigrants land jobs in America similar to those they had back home.
Actually, I'm practicing. I want to see how it will be. That's the first time in my life, and then I'm pretty much interesting. I mean, exciting for this.
Kasim takes the rehearsal seriously, and so do the other 30 or so immigrants here today. This room is filled with doctors and nurses from China and India, engineers from Iran, many in their late 20s and 30s, all with college degrees and ample professional experience back home. And they all know the risk of getting stuck in so-called survival jobs, working as parking lot attendants, cashiers, or taxi drivers. After his mock interview, Joseph De La Rea, a Wells Fargo employee who volunteered to help mentor Kasim, offers some feedback.
You want to be relaxed, you want to be confident. You don't want to appear too scripted or too robotic or too stiff. Okay, it has to seem natural. But these are common questions like, what do you want to do in 5 years? What are your strengths? What are your weaknesses?
After, De La Rea explains why he's here.
My parents are first generation Philippines, and I'm second generation. I just wanted to take the opportunity to give back to some individuals or people in need as well. A lot of the job seekers are very, very interested and eager. They want to get involved and dive in headfirst into the job industry.
After the interview, Kasim seems a bit shell-shocked. He's never been asked before about his strengths or leadership skills or where he saw himself in 5 years.
There are some of the questions. I was not really prepared for them. The feedback is for me to be prepared. I mean, he asked me some questions that I kind of, you know, I made up some answers.
Next up is an American-style networking session. Time to approach strangers, look people in the eye, deliver that 30-second elevator pitch. It can be nerve-wracking for anyone, and especially so for people whose first language isn't English, and who are from countries where you typically get jobs through family connections, not by navigating a room full of strangers.
From a lot of our job seekers, this is the very first time they've been in an American-style networking event, where you're allowed and encouraged to talk with people who you've never met before. How you make small talk, how you slowly get up to the kind of ask about connections with the job, how you follow up with getting their business card, and, you know, keeping that connection alive.
That's Upwardly Global's Gretchen Vierstra. She quickly notices that not everyone is mingling and that a number of the immigrants look daunted. so she offers a few tips.
If it looks like everybody's too busy talking in a group and there's no one to talk to, you can always say, may I join your conversation? Yeah, that's perfectly fine. Okay? So disperse.
Eventually, the room's noisy as job hunters plunge in. Ying Chao, a Chinese nurse, is clearly energized.
It's really good practice. At least right now, I can open my mouth, you know, to talk. You know, before today, you know, I was shy. I was nervous. I don't know what I can talk. I learn a lot.
Now comes the hard part, keeping confident while contacting employers, hoping to apply what they practiced here in the real world. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell, Oakland, California.
Our GeoQuiz today takes us to the Arctic. Canada is one of several nations maneuvering to assert its claim on the Arctic. The U.S., Russia, Norway, and Denmark are also interested in the increasingly ice-free and resource-rich region. Next month, Canada will put on a military show of force in the area. Warships, fighter planes, and ground troops will participate in a military exercise called Operation Nanook. It will take place on two Canadian Arctic islands, which we want you to name. They're Canada's first and third largest islands. Both are part of the territory of Nunavut, and they lie north of the Hudson Strait. More about Operation Nanook and the answer in just a minute. By the way, a few seconds is all you need to sign up for our GeoQuiz texting game. Just text GeoQuiz, one word, to 69866. Today's lucky winners are already posted online. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Today's GeoQuiz was codenamed Operation Nanook. Actually, that's the name of an upcoming Canadian military exercise in the high Arctic. It's part of Canada's effort to assert its claim to the Arctic and its mostly untapped resources. John Ibbotson is Ottawa Bureau Chief for Canada's Globe and Mail newspaper. First of all, John, where is Operation Nanook taking place?
This year, it's Baffin Island and Ellesmere Island, which is sort of the northeast quadrant of the Canadian Arctic archipelago. And there are several reasons for it. One is a bunch of different countries, including Russia and the United States, as well as Canada, are claiming the seabed of the high Arctic. There's a lot of oil and gas there to be explored. So they're all making their different claims, and the United Nations is going to rule on them sometime in the course of this decade. In the meantime, these exercises help to assert your jurisdiction. The second reason is it's getting warmer up there, which means the Northwest Passage is open more and more, which means that ships can go through it. Canada claims that the Northwest Passage is Canadian water. Everybody else says, no, it's not. So, again, this is part of the attempt to claim Canadian jurisdiction. And partly it's just good politics. It makes us feel bullish about a part of the country that, quite frankly, virtually no one has ever visited.
That's kind of ironic.
It is. There's also a personal thing, too. Stephen Harper has been Prime Minister now for more than 5 years. There is some kind of strange link between Stephen Harper and the North. I was up with him last year when, in the middle of one tour, he suddenly literally stole an all-terrain vehicle, went booting around the Arctic tundra with RCMP and security details, fruitlessly trying to catch up with him. So I think he just gets off on it on top of everything else.
So Baffin Island and Ellesmere Island are the two answers to today's GeoQuiz. Now, Canada's combat mission in Afghanistan is winding down. Are troops being diverted from Kandahar to the high Arctic now?
the government has been beefing up its Arctic presence every year, despite the commitment in Afghanistan. There will be announcements later this year of plans to purchase high Arctic naval patrol vessels. There's also talk of a deep water port in the region. So as troops withdraw from Afghanistan, yes, money frees up for future Arctic commitments, although the two have been ongoing 5 years.
Now, there's no real threat of military conflict in the Arctic. You cite numerous reasons for this show of force, but is it directed in some way at Russia?
Last year, Canada chased off some Russian bombers that were getting close to the Arctic borders, and the Conservative government maintained that this proved that we needed a new fleet of F-35 fighter aircraft, which the opposition parties think is more than we can afford. There was no real credible military threat to Canadian interests in the Arctic from Russia any more than there is from the United States. And in fact, everyone knows that the real solution to this is going to involve cooperation, not confrontation, most likely through the Arctic Council. I would contend that much if this is just glorious photo ops during the dog days of summer, Mr. Harper always gets a shot on the front page of the papers as he's standing there with jets flying overhead and icebergs in the distance. It's a great picture. So it's good for domestic politics, but in the end, it's not a question of how many ships we buy or how many jets we fly over how many abandoned barren islands. It's a question of negotiations at the United Nations and in other legal forums such as the Arctic Council.
John Ibbotson, Ottawa Bureau Chief for Canada's Globe and Mail newspaper. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
When people leave their home countries, they can feel isolated and cut off from their community. Radio and social media can help bridge that. But there's another way for one Southeast Asian ethnic group that's been scattered by war. Hmong people here are using teleconferencing to draw together their worldwide community. Anna Boyko-Wyrock has the story.
Sha Vang lives in Bellevue, Washington, a few miles from Microsoft headquarters. She looks nervous, sitting on a couch in her living room, holding a cell phone. Vang is about to sing to hundreds of people on the phone for the first time.
I too old, my voice is no good.
Vang is afraid she's too old, and her voice is no good. 4 times a week, she calls into a teleconference where people share traditional songs called katsia. She dials the number and punches in the PIN code.
Please hold to be placed into the conference.
Then she's connected. While Vang waits for her turn, a Hmong woman from California chimes in with a song about preserving Hmong culture. The Katsia songs are very poetic. Yi Shang of the Hmong Association of Washington says the complicated language can be lost on young people.
The most important thing the elders listen to are these words, and they understand it so well, while us younger Hmong generation, we don't understand it at all. But there's a huge movement in America, too, where even through phone conferences, people would go and sing Gutsia. It's fascinating.
In fact, the teleconferences stretch around the world, and they're not just for traditional songs.
Can you hear me?
Oh, now I hear you. Wait a second.
I contacted the organizers of Longcheng Radio, one of the conference phone lines. And, of course, we spoke over teleconference.
Can you press star 1? I tried it.
Star 1, okay.
Jing Yang is the founder. He says teleconferencing is a way to connect scattered Hmong communities around the world.
We have a lot of people in France, Germany, Russia, Thailand, Laos, Vietnam.
He estimates more than 4,000 people call in to listen to Longcheng Radio. Teleconferences like this have around-the-clock programming. There are shows on folktales, pop culture, health and news. Yang says the hosts translate global news for their audience in the U.S., who might not know what's going on otherwise because of the language barrier.
They see a lot in the news, but they did not figure out what happened in the news because the language barrier.
There's also programming about local Hmong groups, with updates from France and Southeast Asia. Yang says it's a great way to share news that matters to the community.
Okay.
That global connection is vital to Sha Vang in Bellevue, Washington. She finally worked up the courage to share a song with the teleconference. It's a love story. Vang is middle-aged. She lost both parents in the Vietnam War and never went to school. Her siblings are scattered all over the world. Vang says it's easy to feel isolated and get depressed.
Man, I was so mad. Man, I was so feeling bad for me.
I was so mad. I felt so bad for myself. Sometimes I would just go crazy, thinking about everything too much, remembering. I was thinking, oh, maybe I'm the only one in the world who has these problems. Maybe there's no one like me. No one's lived through what I have.
But she says when she listens to the teleconferences, it's almost therapeutic.
But you listen, they're talking.
But then you listen to the singing over the telephone. Like in St. Paul, Minnesota, one woman, Sia, you're like, oh, you don't have a mother or a father either. Your life is the same as mine. You came to the United States all by yourself. You only have yourself, and I only have myself. But I am not alone. Everybody on the phone line has the same problems. That makes me feel better. It makes me happy.
For The World, I'm Anna Boyko-Wyrock in Seattle.
From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the United States Institute of Peace, helping to prevent, manage, and resolve violent international conflict. Online at usip.org. The Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, and the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.